Astute investors sense that the current economic landscape doesn't feel right, but their intuition could be severely understating the present crisis. That's the message from our next guest, renowned economist Charles Hugh Smith. An author of multiple best-selling books, Smith is also a contributing editor at peakprosperity.com and is the founder of the website oftwominds.com. In this highly thought-provoking interview, Smith discusses multiple topics, including the extreme speculation in the stock market, an absurd dynamic in the global bond market, and the Trump administration's myopic view of the fiscal crisis. Simply put, there are too many pressure points for this current paradigm to continue unscathed, and that's why you need to arm yourself with coherent, cohesive strategies outlined at crushthestreet.com/dead. Because at the end of the day, everything you've hoped for financially, including that precious 401k plan, could go up in smoke. Once again, please go to crushthestreet.com/dead. So without further ado, here's Charles Hugh Smith.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into crushthestreet.com. I'm very honored today to have a first-time guest on the show. We're going to have somebody who we are going to be able to pick the mind of, just a brilliant economist, someone who studies the markets. His Charles Hugh Smith. His website is oftwominds.com. His work gets shared and published across a number of popular websites, including Zero Hedge, Peak Prosperity, and the Kaiser Report. And he's somebody that I think you're really going to want to listen to today, especially given the current environment of what is going on with negative interest rates, the ballooning stock market, and this turnaround in gold here in 2019. If you want any of his information, go to his website. He's got some books and free material there for everyone to check out. So Charles Hugh Smith, thanks for coming on Crush the Street with me today.
I'm delighted by the invitation and looking forward to our conversation.
Well, I was looking at a chart today. I've seen this chart before, but I was reminded about it once again in an article I was actually writing today. And the stock market to GDP ratio is, you know, around 150%, the U.S. stock market to the current GDP of the economy. Now, in 1970, there was around 40%. The stock market was only 40%, a much smaller portion of the economy. And I'll start off with this, and you know, by way of introduction, and just kind of by way of starting this conversation, you know, how important is the stock market to today's standard of living? That it goes up, and then the inverse, if it goes down, how impactful is it and consequential is it to the mainstream, the people's livelihood, when the stock market moves?
Well, you know, Kenneth, that is a terrific question because it's really the context of our obsession with the Federal Reserve's policy, right? Because we all know the markets are driven primarily by the Federal Reserve policy. And then what you're asking is, well, why are we so focused on the Fed and the stock market? And it's because the stock market has become a larger percentage of people's wealth, and perhaps if we look at the stock market as a proxy of the financial sector, we'll recognize that the financial sector itself has become a much larger piece of the economy. So in other words, back in that time frame that you mentioned, the end of the sort of glorious 30 post-war years, right, from 1946 to the mid-70s, As I recall, I think the financial sector was around 4 or 5% of the economy, and now it's more like 15 to 20%. So it seems like finance in general is a larger part of our economy, and that's a little bit scary, you know, because it's become more like a casino and less like a savings account.
Yeah. Well, it's so true. And, you know, my partner actually wrote a book, Don't Save for Retirement, and it's a tongue-in-cheek sort of title, but it really talks about how, you know, this retirement from the 80s, the stock market, the pension funds, all these different things, it worked out during this boom, you know, that we've seen in stocks from that time where, you know, it was only 40% of the economy, the stock market, to now 150%. and people are still trying to prepare for their retirement the way they did from that time period of the 80s up until now. But it really seems like we're getting into that bubble phase where this really can't last that much longer, unless maybe it can. Maybe it can be injected to ultra high numbers and manipulated so much that, you know, everything stays normal for, you know, the foreseeable future. I don't know if you would agree with that or not.
Well, that's a good question. I think it's a question all of us are forced to consider, right? Because we are all participants in the Fed's casino now. And let's maybe use housing as one example of a non-stock market asset that it used to be something that went up about 1% a year. And it was kind of like a forced savings plan for the middle class, right? You buy a house and you make the payments and it's worth more and it's reliable. Well, now, because of the Fed's policies of manipulating the market, the mortgage market, by suppressing interest rates, by buying $1.5 trillion of mortgage-backed securities post 2009, which was an extraordinary, unprecedented intervention in the housing market, right? And the whole idea was to make it affordable to buy a house. Well, it's the unintended consequence of that is housing is now part of the casino. And so a lot of people who went in and bought a house in 2006 or seven, and then they lost all their down payment and all their equity in the resulting decline, right? And so it's sort of like we're all now gamblers, and that's the unintended consequence of the Fed policy. And so in the stock market, to go back to that real quickly, as you say about retirement, now people are, whether they're aware of it or not, they may be a government employee, but their pension plan is now been forced into the casino of the stock market because bond yields are so low that pension funds and insurance companies have to, so-called institutional money, have to gamble in the Fed casino as well. And that's created systemic risk, you know, that the whole system is now at risk.
Well, we've seen what happened as soon as monetary policy was starting to tighten. You know, the stock market corrected by 20% in 2018. And here we are with the Fed doing an about face, completely pivoting and the whole world reverting back to negative interest rates. You know, and Ray Dalio talks about the diminishing returns of each dollar that was put into the QE program. And even he believes that there's going to be some new form of QE, that the next layer, the next level of QE, which will likely be some sort of helicopter money, UBI, checks to the people. Is this what you see coming? Some sort of increased injection into the economy to continue to sustain whatever is left of this bubble we have?
Yeah, I think that's a great topic. And I think we have to understand something about the way that money is created and distributed, and it's called the Cantillon effect. And you've probably covered it in previous programs. And what that means is that money is not all equal. In other words, when the Fed injects money into the financial system, it flows to banks and financiers and corporations who then have access to really cheap credit. It doesn't come to us as wage earners, right? The idea is, oh, all of those financiers and corporations and banks are going to invest wisely, and then that's going to help the real economy, and then wages are going to go. But that's really not what's happened. The Fed has created incentives to not to invest in productive assets, but to gamble by buying back your stock, right? So corporations have feasted on this low cost money from the Fed, and they've bought back about $2.5 trillion worth of their stocks, which has pushed the value of the stocks up. And who benefits? Well, roughly 2/3 of all the stocks are owned by the top 10%, right, of the households. And corporate managers, of course, their compensation is largely stock related. So it's sort of like a insider's game, right? And so it's not really benefiting the rest of us, and people are catching up to that. And so hence we have this hue and cry now and political pressure, let's have UBI and QE for the people. But the Federal Reserve isn't really set up to send all of us checks. It would be nice if it was, and maybe it should be, but it isn't. And so that what really happens is the federal government has to borrow $1 trillion, and then it distributes UBI. And I think part of the UBI pressure, Kenneth, is wages have been stagnant for 20 years. While the Fed has ruled the roost, wages have gone nowhere. And that's a complicated issue. But the point is the Fed's powerless to raise wages. And so what it's going to do is keep interest rates low so the federal government can borrow another $1 trillion a year. And that will and then distribute UBI as compensation for the fact that wages have gone nowhere for 20 years.
Yeah. Well, it's a powerful thing. And, you know, I had some questions here and I wanted to throw an impromptu one that kind of came to me as you were talking. And that's bonds. You talked about the casino, how things that were once conventional have turned into gambling, speculation, right? These negative yielding bonds, what, 18 trillion? There's like 30 trillion of real negative yielding debt around the world. But it's like, I think there's 18 trillion in nominal. And this number, it's crazy when you think about it. You know, there's not that many people that would enter into an agreement where they're going to put money in and receive less back at a later period of time. I mean, it just makes no sense. Why would you do that? Of course, there's some people who are speculating. They get into a negative interest rate bond, speculating that interest rates will go even lower, and then therefore their principal goes up, and then they make money, or there's currency hedges, all these different things and reasons why a very sophisticated investor or a gambling investor might get into a negative yielding bond. But conventionally, the safe reason is now completely gone. And so again, it's really getting to this extreme in our economy. The extreme is now normal. And so maybe you can continue from there.
Yeah, no, that's a terrific summary of where we are, Kenneth. And I think we can go back to what's the foundation of capitalism as we understand it in its present manifestation, right? Global and financial. And the basis of capitalism is that capital can earn a return. And so central banks lowering interest rates to zero or negative rates, it's like, well, then capital can't earn a safe return. And this takes away the discipline of the market. And so, and we see this, like, say, as an example, say GE, right? GE was considered a premium blue chip company. They basically went to the Fed's casino and borrowed tremendous sums of money because it was cheap, right? And then they bought back their own stock to keep their stock elevated. Meanwhile, their real world business was decaying, right? Not doing well. And I think that's really kind of an analogy for what happens when you lower interest rates to zero is you take away the discipline in which capitalism depends on. In other words, that a lender offers capital, right, at a return that's related to risk. But when you force interest rates down to zero, you've removed the risk return discipline. And so then you start getting moral hazard, right? Where you just more corporations and financiers and banks are borrowing huge sums of money and gambling with it because, hey, why not? The Fed's got our back. And that's really destructive to capitalism as a system.
Right. Yeah, there's a misalignment of what incentivizes productive behavior in our economy. So Charles, you know, we have a situation now where the president that we have now, Donald Trump, is pushing for low interest rates. And even if it needs to go negative, he's okay with that. What do you think this pedal to the metal approach is coming from Donald Trump?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I've never been asked that. But if we look at his history, he's basically a real estate investor / speculator, right? That probably from his point of view as a businessman who relies on credit, if you look at his history, and I'm not an expert on his, you know, all of his hotels and so on, but as a general sort of perspective on Donald Trump, clearly he's been credit dependent. He's borrowed huge amounts of money, leveraged stuff, and profited from that system. And so, of course, from his point of view, the cheaper the credit becomes, the better for people like him. But I don't think he's really, I think he's missing the part about you've removed the discipline and you've taken away capital's low risk yield. And so, you know, there's kind of a saying where capital goes where it's treated best. And I don't think zero interest rates or negative rates is treating capital well. It's basically pushing capital into casinos where whether the owners of the capital want to or not, they have to gamble. And the problem with gambling is that you can lose. It's sure. It's an inherently risky proposition. And so when you look at the stock market, like you said, at 140, 150% of GDP, that's stretching valuations by, you know, historical means. And so it's certainly looking like it's high risk, you know, by historical standards. And you can't de-risk something like a bubble.
All right, Charles. So I'd like to address this topic of what seems to be every country, you know, burning their own house down, following in the footsteps of the US and, you know, massive amounts of QE and zero and negative interest rate policies. And, you know, one thing I'd point out is, you know, the Greek 10-year bond is yielding roughly the same thing as the U.S. 10-year bond. And apples to apples, you know, you'd almost think like that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? You know, we like Greek food, but we don't necessarily want a bond from Greece. So, you know, having said all of that, and acknowledging that the U.S. is in an unsustainable situation, you know, how do we, you know, try to wrap our minds around this concept that the U.S. is possibly the cleanest shirt in a basket of dirty laundry?
Well, that's a great topic. And let's dig into some just sort of general context for that, which is like how much debt does the world have now, right? And then how much income is going to have to be devoted to service that debt, right? And so we can start with, like, say, China has famously generated about $40 trillion worth of new credit in the last decade. And then you can add, and that's a pretty significant sum. That's at least twice the size of their GDP, maybe three times. And then you look at Europe and that their ECB expansion in Japan and the U.S., and it kind of, if you kind of look at all these numbers, you realize the U.S. with the Fed generating about $3 trillion in money out of thin air, that's actually fairly modest on the global stage, given that the U.S. GDP is about $20 trillion. And so that's part of why the U.S. is the cleanest shirt in the laundry, is we've actually generated way too much, you know, free money for financiers, but it's considerably less in terms of if you measure it in GDP. And you can also, I think, look at the strength of the U.S. economy. It's burdened by too much regulation and, you know, the Federal Reserve policies, sort of perverse incentives. But there's still a lot of flexibility in the U.S. economy, and there's a lot of innovation. And so that's, I think, one of the foundations why money could very well flow to the U.S. is that the real economy in the U.S. is more diverse, more flexible, more responsive than many other economies.
So let's talk about gold in this situation. If the U.S. dollar becomes the safe haven, does that become a problem for gold in terms of U.S. dollars? Or are you of the belief that there's a possibility that we could see gold move higher alongside the U.S. dollar?
That's one of my favorite topics, actually, because if you look at a long-term chart of the dollar and gold, you realize that for long periods of time, they do go up together. It's not a seesaw. And we can easily understand why, is that foreign capital might seek dollar-based assets like treasury bonds. It's a very liquid market, so they would be demand for dollars. And at the same time, they want gold too as a hedge against the whole central bank system falling apart. And I think what's interesting about gold coming off of its 8-year, you know, kind of period of stagnation and decline is I'm thinking that maybe the common household,
the small investor is now awakening to the same kind of risks that we're talking about. And now there's an interest in precious metals because maybe for the first time, people are starting to feel they need a hedge against the central bank regime failing to do what it's promised, which is keep the bubble of inflated forever and no more recessions ever again in human history. And basically that's what's being promised.
So Charles, it's been said that precious metals make up of less than 0.5% of what US investors hold as a percentage of their portfolio. And Citibank has even just put out a price prediction for gold of 2000 by 2020. Having discussed all of this macroeconomics and everything we've just discussed, I mean, what are your thoughts on this for precious metals going forward here?
Well, I'm not going to, I'm not qualified to make any predictions, but I think that, I think you raised a very critical context here, which is what percentage of the global financial assets are in precious metals? And I've made the same comparison to Bitcoin, which is even smaller market. So gold is, as you say, roughly, I don't know, about a $3 trillion market, $6 trillion. And there's about $3,300 trillion in global financial assets kind of floating around looking for a home. And so that is clearly a very small percentage. And so gold could, say, go up fivefold, and it would still be a very modest percentage of total global financial assets. And I think the other context I like to use is what are the super wealthy doing with their money? Because they've hired the best minds, and they're always interested in earning a return, but they're very risk averse. Because the main thing is, if you're, say, managing 100 million, not to mention 100 billion, but if you're managing 100 million, your prime directive is don't lose 40% of this in some stock market gamble or some stock market crash or some bond crash. And so if that's your prime directive, then you're going to have to start looking at owning assets that aren't so vulnerable to a collapse in the everything bubble. And you would justify this to your clients by saying, look, we've got to have a hedge here against a decline. Now, what percentage do we want to say is the probability that the stock market could take a big hit or that the bond market could take a hit? Regardless of what probability you assign that, you still need a hedge. And so that's where that's the kind of my line of thinking about what's coming up is the wealthy are definitely going into Bitcoin and gold. I mean, there's evidence of that. And if we can understand why, then we can kind of tag along for the
sake. You bought a Bitcoin, and that's you struck a nerve with me. When you do that, I love what we're seeing right now in the crypto space, specifically Bitcoin and its sound money principles. And a lot of people get confused. They think if, you like Bitcoin, you hate gold, or you think it's going to replace gold. And I don't see that to be true. I see it as another option for people. And competition for money is good. It makes money better, I would argue. So, what are your thoughts on Bitcoin, especially as in regards to, managed money starting to get involved with Bitcoin? I mean, using it maybe as a non-correlated asset in a basket of their portfolio. I mean, what is the implications of this going forward here as we go into 2020 and beyond?
You know, you hit on a key point that's extremely insightful, which is Bitcoin non-correlated to other assets? Because that's part of what we see in the everything bubble is it's everything's correlated now, bonds and stocks and real estate and art. And so if Bitcoin is non-correlated, if it's a different asset class, then that makes it interesting as a hedge, right? Because you don't want to have all your assets correlated. And so, yeah, I think you're absolutely right too about diversity of money. And, you know, people say, well, why can't we have a gold-backed currency? And I would say, yeah, that's great. I would love to have a private sector gold-backed currency, you know, that wasn't state issued. The more types of money we have that are transparent, the better off we all are, because, you know, the better money will attract capital, and the weaker money will lose capital. And that's the way it should be. So Bitcoin, again, is a very small market. But again, look at what the wealthy are doing. And there's some evidence that the wealthy are piling into Bitcoin. And it's like, why? The people that are hiring the smartest people that have the most to lose, if they're going into Bitcoin, we should at least explore why they seem to be doing so.
Charles Hugh Smith, everyone. Charles, thank you so much for your time here at Crush the Street. Truly, greatly appreciated. If people want to learn more about the work you do, the things that you write, and things that you follow, please let them know where they can go and what they can expect to find.
Okay. Thank you, Kenneth. Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com. Read some free sample chapters of my books. And everything there is free.
Awesome. Thank you, Charles, so much for coming on the show today.
It's been my pleasure.